This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing, my chance to talk with artists, policymakers, and performers, to hear their stories, what inspires their creations, what decisions change their careers, what relationships influenced their work. Today, we talk oil and its aftermath. In a 2014 opinion issued in the Southern District of New York, Judge Lewis Kaplan wrote, quote, "This case is extraordinary. The facts are many and sometimes complex. They include things that normally come only out of Hollywood," unquote. Like most stories that end up in court, this is one with two very different points of view. My guest today, Stephen Donziger, represents one side of the case. According to him, when Texaco, later acquired by Chevron, stopped drilling for oil in the Amazon rainforest, millions of gallons of toxic waste remained in its wake. For over two decades, a group of Ecuadorians has waged a class-action lawsuit over what environmentalists have dubbed the Amazon Chernobyl. One review of Crude, a 2009 documentary by Joe Berlinger about the case, reads, quote, "If you like stories with real-life good guys and bad guys, then Crude is for you." Donziger, as lead attorney representing the Ecuadorian plaintiffs, has been fighting this fight for over 20 years. Chevron claims that the required cleanup has already taken place and that the remaining pollution is the responsibility of Petroecuador, the state-owned oil company. Stephen Donziger says Chevron is waging a massive retaliation campaign against him. But this story starts with Texaco.
They created what is probably the world's worst oil contamination ever. They dumped billions of gallons of toxic waste, even by their own admission, into the streams and rivers and soils of the Amazon rainforest. There were several indigenous groups and farmer communities living in the area when this happened, and they essentially poisoned the ecosystem, the water supply that thousands of people relied on for their drinking water, for bathing, for fishing, and for their very survival.
Which had been pristine rainforest down there before Texaco went down and found oil, correct?
That's exactly right. It had been pretty much pristine rainforest until the mid-60s when Texaco showed up and found oil, and they had a huge concession from Ecuador's government, 1,500 square miles. They built and developed 10 different oil fields. There were hundreds of well sites, about 1,000 of these open-air toxic waste pits. They just dug the dirt out of the jungle floor and dumped all the drilling muds, which contained carcinogens, benzene, and the like, oil sludge right into the jungle. And they built these pits on hills, and generally they would put pipes on the side of them and run off the surplusage through the pipe down into streams and rivers.
So, and a big part of this is that the produced water that results from drilling, which in the U.S., I'm told, their common practice is to reinject it back into the ground, into some safer.
Yes.
They did not do that in
Ecuador. They did not do it. They really cut corners to the max.
They made lagoons of it everywhere.
And granted, this was an isolated part of the forest at that time, but there were indigenous groups that had lived there for millennia that were living and prospering in this beautiful environment, and they just dump toxic oil and oil waste right into the streams and rivers that they relied on for their sustenance. People were treated with a complete lack of respect.
And those people that were there, the indigenous people there in that part of Ecuador, none of them were included, if I understand it correctly, in the development of the area, meaning all outside labor was brought from Ecuador. They had a lot of high-paying jobs, or relatively speaking, for Ecuador, and they brought them in. And the people who were the local people were just sidelined to, like, basket weaving or, like, some little selling trinkets.
That's generally true, except for one task, which was to clean up or purport to clean up the oil spills.
Well, I want to go back. So Texaco has the find in the 60s, and they developed the oil fields there for like a 22-year, 20-plus-year period. And then, correct me if I'm wrong, or take me through what happens when Chevron absorbs Texaco.
Well, you know, first of all, Chevron knew when it bought Texaco that it was not off the hook. What had happened is that after we initially filed our lawsuit way back in 1993, this is probably the world's longest lawsuit.
It seems that way. It seems that way.
Yeah. And instead of dealing with the problem and dealing directly with the communities, Texaco went directly to Ecuador's government and said, oh, we'll put a pittance of money, $40 million, and you give us a release. But very importantly, the release did not release the private claims of our clients. Our lawsuit is a private lawsuit brought by private citizens against a private company. It's a civil lawsuit. This has already been resolved by multiple courts in our favor. But Chevron to this day, for public relations and other purposes, still tries to raise this issue like, oh, we cleaned up, we were released. I mean, first of all, the cleanup didn't really happen. And second, the legal document itself does not release them from the private claims.
Where'd you grow up?
Jacksonville, Florida.
In Jacksonville. And what'd your dad do?
He was a small businessman in the television picture tube business.
And what did your mom do?
She was
a troublemaker.
Yeah. My mom was an editor of a local newspaper for the Jewish community in Jacksonville. And she was a substitute school teacher and, you know, spent a lot of time at home with my sister and I. She was a great mom.
And what was your childhood like in terms of your own political advocacy?
Well,
or social consciousness.
Yeah, I developed a social conscience at a young age. The world, at a very young age, struck me as a very unfair place to a lot of people, and it bothered me greatly. My mom helped cultivate that. We went to protests in front of local grocery stores, you know, in support of Cesar Chavez and the Farm Workers Union when I was, you know, young, 10, 11, 12 years old. I met a local elected official in my hometown, Steve Padgick, who was a huge inspiration for me. He was a really great politician who had a deep social conscience. And as I became a teenager, I took it upon myself to really try to learn the stuff that I wasn't being taught in school about, you know, how the world was really working.
For example?
Oh, just the degree of you know, injustice, the you know, issues having to do with race, poverty, the stuff that that schools weren't really putting at the fore in terms of teaching kids.
Mm-hmm. Your mother had you do something with Chavez?
Yeah.
And what did you do?
Well, we went to a grocery store and, you know, we were, you know, we basically organized a boycott of a local chain of grocery stores, Winn-Dixie in Jacksonville.
Yeah, of course.
Because they were, you know, Cesar Chavez was trying to boycott the grocery store for various labor-related issues in California related to the farm workers unions.
How old were you then?
I think I was about 12 or 13, maybe, you know, in that area, but... But, you know, look, I had a fun childhood. I mean, I don't want to act like all I did was sit around and protest.
Right.
I mean, it was one of the many
make posters,
I did, including, you know, swimming.
With red lines through lettuce leaves.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, we did a lot of surfing. I mean, we grew up near the beach. You know, I had a really healthy, active childhood, but I always sort of felt like I wanted to utilize whatever professional talents I might one day develop on behalf of people who are getting screwed over.
It's interesting how people... The people develop that sense of social injustice very young.
Yes.
And you look at the world as a place where there are powerful people that are abusing powerless people, and you want to do something about it.
Yeah, that's very true. And look, I grew up in an upper middle class family. I mean, I had a lot of opportunity, but I decided, you know, as I went through college and then law school.
Where'd you go undergraduate?
American University in D.C.
Yeah, I went to GW for 3 years.
I wanted to be like in D.C. near the politics. You know, at that time, I sort of was under what I think is now a mistaken notion that like it was all decided in Washington when I realized it's actually decided in other places.
Right. A lot of time in courtrooms.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. So I wanted to be in D.C. And then from there, I went. I was, you know, fortunate enough to get into Harvard Law School. I mean, I say fortunate enough because I met some incredibly fabulous people there who do really.
Was that the goal when you were at AU?
No. I mean, it didn't even occur to me I'd be qualified, honestly, to get into a place like Harvard. I ended up getting, I did well academically. I was very interested in the subject matter, liked it there.
How did you change at Harvard? You're in law school. You're one of the top law schools in the world. What was that experience
Harvard
like for you?
Harvard puts right in front of you like this choice, and it's a fundamental, profound choice about life. And because Harvard, you know, when you go to Harvard and come out with a Harvard degree, especially a Harvard Law School, you can do almost anything you want in the legal profession and in other professions. Or you can do almost anything you want, you know, fighting the power structure that keeps people down. So, you know, when people get out of law school, many of them are, you know, burdened with debt and their choices can become limited because of the financial thing. It takes a lot of, I think, you know, commitment to this kind of work, to choose a path that most people would consider to be complicated and hard. I mean, for me, it never was. My first job out of law school was working for the public defender in Washington, D.C., defending children accused of crimes in D.C. Out of Harvard, yeah. I mean, I made virtually no money, but I loved the job. I was in court, and it was so interesting, and I learned so much. I mean, skills that I carry forward with me to this day in the work I do now in Ecuador. So
right away when you get out, yeah. Do good for others versus do well for yourself line, you made a clear choice.
I made a clear choice, but I also don't want to, you know, overplay it in the sense that I enjoy the work. You know, it's not altruism.
Sure.
It makes me feel good about myself, and it's challenging on so many levels. It's fascinating.
And you've been very upfront about this one case where if you survive, you know, if you prevail, you could make a lot of money.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right. I mean, I want to make let me put it this way. The purpose of the case The purpose of the case is not to make money for lawyers. The purpose of the case is to help people who are being grievously harmed and even being killed by cancers and exposures to toxins. However, the model of the case that has allowed this case to be, I think, break new ground, and the unique aspect of this case, to me, is our ability to harness what I would call the capitalist model, the free market model in the law, to bring in significant resources from investors and others so we can get in the same ballpark as a company like Chevron, which you have to remember, they're not only trying to win the case, they're trying to kill the idea of the case because they don't want lawyers like us doing this kind of work ever in the future. So it's important. The money aspect is important. And look, if I end up collecting a fee, I don't know that I will. It's never what's motivated me. The plan, my personal plan, and I think other lawyers on the case feel the same way, is to use some of that money to leverage it back into the fight for social justice around the world.
I love that in this New Yorker magazine article that I went back and read again, they quote, in 2008, a Chevron lobbyist in Washington told Newsweek, "We can't let little countries screw around with big companies like this." And then one Chevron spokesman said, "We're going to fight this until hell freezes over, and then we'll fight it out on the ice."
Yes.
I love that quote.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, the psychology of a major company that's Chevron that's almost always gets its way around the world. And what a company does, in this case Chevron, when you actually harness the power of a community-based movement. Remember, there are communities on the ground in the Amazon, indigenous and farmer communities that are behind this case. They have a democratic organization down there that runs the case, that hired me, that hires other lawyers. The power that you can create when you organize properly at the grassroots level and you're smart enough to connect that up with capital, that is, you know, people who have money to back it, understanding that they can actually themselves make money off of the claim, is what's absolutely paradigmatic shifting about this case. I mean, because they've never seen a situation where a Harvard law grad and many other people, it would be a mistake to say that it's primarily me. I mean, there are a lot of people working on
this. It's a team.
It's a team. But, you know, I've been the only lawyer still left who was in it in 1993. But what they don't like is a guy like me and others who have access to the power structure, the elite hedge funds, you know, classmates of mine who are in very powerful positions, including the President of the United States, can connect up with, you know, people in the jungle who don't have any money. I mean, their business model does not account for what has happened here, okay, which is why they're fighting it so hard, why they're spending so much money, why they refuse to settle the case.
How did the government of Ecuador evolve over the time that you've done the case? Because if I read about different administrations that have come in, some have been more disposed toward helping you than others, correct?
Well, look, you know, what Chevron and what Texaco and now Chevron has countered on in Latin America, but really all over the world, is that they can go into a place, do a deal with the government, get access to oil, and just work the system in their favor. I mean, you know, there was significant economic advancement in Ecuador because of oil. There still is to this day. I mean, they're a member of OPEC. You know, oil is a huge part of the national budget. Even with prices down, it's a very important part of what's allowed the country to develop socially. Now, what we experienced, remember, I started going down there in 1993. I've been down there about 250 times. I used to go to Ecuador like you would fly on the shuttle to D.C. from New York. I mean, I would go for a day meeting, come right back, okay? Luckily, it's the same time zone as New York, so it wasn't that, you know, it didn't really shake me up too much. But I've been there many, many times. In 2007, a man named Rafael Correa was elected president. He was a former professor, young guy, very nationalistic, has a PhD in economics from a U.S. university, very capable. And over the last 10 years, he's been president, and I think the country has changed. What's changed in terms of the Ecuador case, in terms of the Chevron case, is you finally had a president of Ecuador who cared about what was happening to his own citizens, these indigenous groups and farmer communities in the jungle, these impoverished groups.
And in Berlinger's film, he shows up.
Yeah, Berlinger's film, he shows up. You know, so for the first time you have a president who goes down, sees what really happened, the oil's visible all over the place, talks to the people, and says, this is one of the biggest outrages I've ever seen.
Very often, the guys like that, they're sincere at the moment that they say that.
Yes, yes.
And then things evolve. How is he held up as an ally?
Look, this is the thing. Okay, he has his job. We have our job. We don't work together. We're not part of the same team. He's the government. We're a private lawsuit. However, I think it's important for the world to recognize that Rafael Correa, the president of Ecuador, the first person ever to go down there and see the damage and talk about it, has stood by the victims. Okay, he hasn't interfered with the lawsuit. And what I decided, along with my colleagues in Ecuador, was that until we convince the country, public opinion, that this was a battle between a country that had been completely screwed over by an American company and that company, as opposed to the indigenous people only in Texaco, we would never win the case. So we spent a hell of a lot of time doing media work and speaking at schools and universities.
You had been a journalist temporarily, if
yes,
I read correctly, before.
I was a journalist.
Describe
before
that
I became
work.
A lawyer. I worked in Nicaragua during the height of the Contra War. I worked there from 1984 to 1987, saw young people
Three
die.
3 years.
Covered the war, lived in Managua. Traveled.
For who?
I worked initially for United Press International, then I freelanced for a bunch of papers, the Christian Science Monitor, Philadelphia Inquirer. I mean, that was back when people read newspapers,
right.
You know, and I made a living writing freelance stories out of Managua.
You'd already graduated from Harvard Law School?
No, oh. I had graduated. That was between
undergrad
and law school. I did that for 4 years, and then I went to law school. I mean, that's where I really learned about the culture, the Spanish. And, you know, when I went to law school and got out of law school, because of that previous experience in Latin America, I was able to sort of build on that because I said, I've got to do legal work in Latin America. I, like, love the region too much, and I want to sort of somehow figure out a role for myself down there and ended up in this case. But
what did you learn during that period that helped you later on?
Well, look, I mean, isn't it all part of the same power structure? First of all, in Nicaragua, I saw, you know, a battle for social justice against a U.S.-backed dictator. I saw, you know, the sacrifices people were willing to make to get the most basic things in life that many people in the U.S. take for granted. And I understood what it meant, you know, in a way that I could never probably get from living in the United States. And it gave me perspective. Okay, I mean, from that point forward, nothing ever seemed too big for me. You know, nothing ever seemed too complicated or too, you know,
unbelievable.
Unbelievable. Like, you know, I mean, I felt terribly lucky, you know, to have grown up in a place where I had the space, you know, to develop the way I've developed. Because there is many countries in the world, as you know, when people speak out, they get killed or they get put in jail.
Or they get bought off.
Yeah, and they get bought off. And that just sort of made me redouble my commitment to wanting to do what I wanted to do with my life. You know, it's like I've got to do something.
Why?
Here. Yeah.
Why?
Well, look, I mean, I, you know.
Well, you could have done a little of that. You could have been like most people in New York I know, where you made a lot of money, and then you had a dinner and you gave money to help the people down there.
My wife keeps telling me, why don't you do it that way? Our lives would have been so much better.
She wants you to be home with her. She loves you.
You could have done this, like, you know, 5 hours a week.
Could have made a few million bucks a year and given them $25,000 a table. But you didn't do that. Why?
You know. Look, I never wanted not to make money. I mean, I like money, or at least enough to be financially secure and enjoy my life. And look, my wife and I both work, and we make enough money to live relatively comfortably.
Yeah.
There's no complaints. We have one kid. We live in Manhattan. You know, we're not wealthy by any means, but we live fine. We take a vacation or a couple, two, 3 years. We're okay, man. It's all good. If we win the case, obviously, I will hopefully recover a percentage of the thing, which is, by the way,
22 years of your life you spent.
And if I'm able to get that, I'll be in a different position. I mean, our goal, my wife and I have discussed this extensively along with the clients, and we want to create an entity to continue to do the work in other places.
Explore the Here's the Thing archives, where I talk with Joe Berlinger, the director of Crude, on why he makes films about real events.
I mean, the idea of capturing human drama in all its ambiguous glory as it unfolds before the camera is, first of all, an incredible way to make a film, and secondly, to have faith.
Take a listen at heresthething.org. This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. My guest today is Stephen Donziger, the lawyer who represents a group of Ecuadorian people in a landmark, decades-long class-action lawsuit against Chevron. The case has been fought both in Ecuador and the United States. In 2011, Donziger won in Ecuador, and it was a big win, resulting in a $9.5 billion judgment against Chevron. However, 3 years later in New York, federal judge Lewis Kaplan declared that this judgment could not be enforced in the United States due to what Kaplan described as, quote, dishonest and corrupt measures of Donziger's team that led to the verdict in Ecuador. Donziger is currently appealing the Kaplan decision. If Donziger prevails and Chevron pays, he could see a large amount of cash, although that wasn't the goal.
Look, I never did this for the money. I'm thrilled to be able to do it and make enough money to live, you know, relatively comfortably. I do want the money, though, if I can get it, because I want to continue to do this work and train and fund other lawyers to do this work around the world. I mean, I want to help create new capacity on the progressive side of the law to fight these powerful corporations that, to me, are abusing the law. You know, I can tell you, I personally have been targeted with what is probably the most well-funded corporate retaliation campaign ever. If you Google me, you'll get all this negative stuff about
me. But I want to get to, what did you do about the litigation finance thing?
Who created that
or someone came to you with the idea?
So, you know, look, you know.
You needed money.
I needed to be creative about getting money because, you know, look, for several years, the case sort of went along at a certain level and we were fine. Well, it was clear we were going to win the case in Ecuador, where Chevron wanted it. They decided to try to destroy the case. And the turning point was in May 2009 when 60 Minutes ran a segment on the case, and it made them look terrible. They interviewed me, and a couple days later, I got an internal email from Chevron, because I've litigated against them and gotten some of their documents, and they said, let's go after this lawyer, because they calculated that I was like at the center of it all. If they could cut off the head, the whole thing
would
collapse.
Very Nixon White House strategy.
Very Nixonian strategy. Yeah. And they hit me with everything they have. I mean, they sued me under the civil racketeering statute. Yeah. They sued me for $60 billion. I live in a two-bedroom apartment, okay? Imagine coming home, you know, to your wife and say, hey, honey, you know, she says, how'd your day go? And you say, it was okay, except I got sued for $60 billion today. You know,
I put it at the end of the list. I say, well, I had a nice lunch with my mom, and then I went and bought you some flowers. Yeah, right. Oh, and I got sued for $60 billion by Chevron.
Exactly.
I mean,
no one, as far as my research tells me, no individual in our country's history had ever been sued for so much money, okay? And I was being sued because I had litigated.
What year was that?
This was in...
After the 60 Minutes piece.
Yeah, this was in... Okay, so the 60 Minutes was in 2009. They actually hit me with the lawsuit on February 1st, 2011, okay? And on that day, I was flying down to Ecuador. I got off the plane in Miami to change planes. My BlackBerry was blowing up, and I was like, holy shit, they really did it. Like, I couldn't believe they actually were going to do that.
Where is that case now?
Well, we ended up litigating it, and they won. I mean, how do I explain this? They dropped all the $60 billion on the eve of trial. They dropped all the damages claims because under our system, our legal system, if you're sued for money, you get a jury. If you're not sued for money, you don't get a jury. So in order to do that, they dropped all the money damages, and they would not be attacking us to this degree had we not effectively called them out for what we believe are their environmental crimes and fraud.
So just to finish this, so when you come up with the idea that you need the money and you're going to monetize this with the litigation finance, you came up with this idea or someone came to you and suggested try this? And how did you do it? Where does the money come from?
So it comes from different sources. It comes from a combination of wealthy individuals and organized hedge funds that invest in litigation.
Patton Boggs
is a law firm that helped us raise money. They're a major law
firm.
Burford
Capital?
Burford was a fund. Woodsford was a fund. Mr. De Leon was an individual. He didn't have a fund, but he would invest personally. I mean, this is a guy I went to law school with, by the way, who ended up making a lot of money in the internet poker space. And he became very wealthy. And he was in the Latino Law Students Association with me at Harvard. And we stayed in touch, and he ended up funding a lot of the case. But we have had a diverse sources of money that have backed this case through the years, and it's really the key to our success. It's pretty clear to them now that we're not going away.
So take me like a baseball box score just through the beats of the highlights.
So these are the highlights. 93, we start the case in the U.S. They wanted it in Ecuador. We fought to keep it in the U.S. They won that battle. So in 2001, we go back to Ecuador. A lot of people said, don't go. You waste your time. It's like this union leader told me, it'll never happen. You're wasting your time. But we did it anyway. And then, you know, the case started to go real slowly. They were trying to sabotage the process. The new guy gets elected, you know.
What was his name again?
Rafael Correa.
Correa.
Then we win the case in 2011.
$18 billion.
$18 billion. In 2013, it got affirmed by the Supreme Court, but the money got halved because they took out a punitive damages component, which is unfortunate. So the judgment ended up being $9.5 billion, but interest runs the more they delay now.
Supreme Court of Ecuador.
Yeah. And right now the judgment's worth about $10 billion, which, by the way, might seem like a lot of money, but it really isn't.
But there were also movements, if I'm not mistaken, because I'm not just only relying on the New Yorker magazine, because I read a bunch of different articles online about you and about the case, is that also Chevron, in the way that they tried to move the case out of the U.S. into Ecuador, they tried to move it back to the U.S.
Yes.
And then you got jurisdiction, you got a ruling in Canada.
Yeah. So yeah. Okay. So again, the highlights. We file in the U.S. It goes to Ecuador at their request. We win in Ecuador. They then, to retaliate, come back to the U.S. where we originally wanted the case to happen and sue me personally, sue my colleague Pablo Fajardo personally. He's a lawyer in Ecuador.
This is Kaplan's case. The judge on that case.
Kaplan's the judge. Hated my guts. I mean, part of my problem with Kaplan is that Joe Berlinger, the acclaimed documentary filmmaker, had made a movie about the case, and which came out in 2009, mm-hmm. premiered at Sundance. And I was one of the protagonists in the film, along with Pablo and some others. Chevron was able to subpoena from Berlinger hundreds of hours of his outtakes.
Yeah, let's go through that for a minute, because to get to the film and to some of the white water that you hit later in the case, I think, if I'm not mistaken, Chevron saw a cut of the film, and there was something in there that was later omitted from a cut of the film, which is what prompted him to say, give us the 600 hours, and we want to see what else you omitted.
I mean, look, Joe Berlinger followed us around for 3 years. Joe and I became very comfortable. Joe has me talking very frankly about my frustrations, my fears.
Your strategy.
Strategy, my joy, lots of very personal things. And I personally, as well as my clients, made a conscious decision to cooperate with Joe because we felt like it was far more important to get this story told than to somehow adhere to some sort of notion of the law that you should never work with a filmmaker during a case, which, by the way, many lawyers work with filmmakers. So I think it was a wise choice to work with Joe. What Chevron did is they got all his outtakes. Well, I didn't remember half the stuff I had said over 3 years. And and they found snippets of me saying some admittedly stuff that I probably should not have said. Stuff like, all the judges here are corrupt. And then I'd say, I talked about Chevron out of frustration. I said, you know, if you tell a lie 1,000 times, it becomes the truth. I said that in reference to Chevron. The way Chevron edited the outtakes, they cut out the part where I talked
about
Chevron. And they say, this is his philosophy. You know, so...
And there was a big legal battle with Joe, and he invoked some freedom of the press or what have you.
Yeah, the journalist privilege, which was, I mean, Joe just got...
And they punctured that, and they got the 600 hours, and
they got
watched
the 600
hours. What was the net result of that?
For your world, the journalist world, I think it was terrible. I mean, basically, Joe Berlinger's an artist, and he had to turn over his art. I mean, it was just a super bad result. For us, I think it created a certain sensation that something might have been wrong with the way we litigated the case, which has taken us a really long time to combat because Chevron, you know, has so many resources, and they have websites up about this kind of stuff. But in the end of the day, it was never evidence in the Ecuador case. It was never relied on by the court. And most of the outtakes show us doing what we should do.
Where's the case at now?
Well, in Ecuador, it's over. I mean, we've gotten the decision affirmed by the Supreme Court.
Where's the case with Kaplan now?
Oh, the case with Kaplan. It's on appeal. It's on appeal.
Right.
But ultimately, look, there's nothing Kaplan can do to block the villagers from enforcing their judgment outside the United States.
And where do you think that'll happen?
I think it's most likely to happen in Canada.
You do. So it's safe to assume that right now you're waiting for this somewhat reduced verdict, like $9.5 billion or whatever it is. What's the amount now?
It's about $10
billion. So $10 billion, you're waiting for a ruling potentially from the Canadian court that you can access Chevron's assets there.
That's exactly right. Look, the key...
Any idea what the timeline is for that?
The key point of action, the center of the action now is in Canada. It's in Toronto.
How long do you think that'll take?
Well, it depends.
Will Chevron grind that down?
It depends. Chevron's strategy is grind it down. Right now, they're trying to basically relitigate everything that happened.
You have one child?
I have one child. He's 9.
You're a girl. He's a boy.
Yeah, 9.
What's his name?
Matthew.
So Matthew Donziger might be the attorney sitting in the courtroom in Canada that collects the check for, you know, you and I will be gone. We'll be dead. And Matthew Donziger will be like,
look,
pay to the order of Matthew Donziger.
I hope not. I hope not. But, it's possible. Look, it doesn't matter to me at this point, okay? We are going to stay in this as long as it takes. A message needs
Why?
To be sent. A message needs
Why
to be
Why have you done this? If this is you haven't taken any other cases?
No, I've done a lot of other cases.
You've done a lot of other cases.
I've done a lot of other cases.
And
right now, over the last years, I've mostly worked on this, but I've worked on different law firms. I've done a lot of different cases. And look, there's other stuff I want to do too and plan to do. I mean, right now, it takes a lot of time because we need to sort of get some things organized in Canada in terms of the financing for the next few years and that kind of stuff. But, I see a day in the not too distant future where I think this whole thing can resolve in the favor of the Ecuadorians. And this
they might settle?
Well, I think ultimately if we get near their assets in Canada, they're going to be forced to settle. I mean, they're not going to let their assets be seized.
Always good if they settle. I want to read you one thing. Not everyone embraced Donziger's leadership. Esperanza Martinez, who runs Oil Watch Sudamerica, an environmental group in Quito, told me, I confess the intense personality that Steve has. It's a struggle for me. Sarah Lee Whitson, a longtime friend of his who is now at Human Rights Watch, acknowledged that some people are put off by Donziger's stubbornness and his theatricality. But it was precisely these qualities, she said, that enabled him to take on an oil giant. Quote, he's a leader, and the fact that he's the one who has been with the case for over a decade has kept it going. What was it like for you in Berlinger's film to see yourself? What did you think when you saw yourself?
Look, I don't...
Because you do come across, and I don't begrudge this. I mean, we all have to have confidence in what we do. You have to convey confidence for leadership. To convince people of the rightness of what you do, we have to strike a certain pose. And you do come across from time to time as a big fan of yourself in the film. And you're thinking. You're very confident.
I'm a big fan of myself. I mean, I think... Look... I think what we as a team have put together and accomplished is extraordinary. I'm thrilled with what we've accomplished.
Right.
I mean, people look at me like, oh, you've been attacked, you've been sued. No. But, look, you asked me how I
see yourself
in the film. I have to say it was mixed. I mean, I didn't come across, it was complicated. I there were aspects of my personality that I would see on the screen. It didn't really make me feel very good about myself. But, look, I've been in this over 20 years. I've evolved as a person. I mean, there were times I couldn't go a day down there without yelling at people because I was so frustrated by the complacency of this Ecuadorians who were being victimized. The same people, they're like, you've got to fight. This isn't an American battle. It's an Ecuadorian battle. Do this. Fight. And ultimately, as we built up our team and learned how to deal with these people and eventually won the case, it's very much now in the hands of the Ecuadorians. I mean, this case is not about Steven Donziger. This case is about people in Ecuador who are now fighting back with the help of international allies like myself. But it is not my case. I do not own the case. It is owned by them. And ultimately, they can fire me any day they want if they don't want me to work for them anymore.
Two last things. Would you like to see a movie made of this case, and who would play you in the movie?
Look, there's been talk of a movie. I and the people I work with want to have a movie.
Have you
made.
Talked to any movie people?
I have talked to some movie people. But, the person who would play me would have to have tremendous fire in the belly.
They'd have to be angry.
They'd have to be angry.
But for the right reason.
I mean, look, I have a very wide range of emotions. I don't know if it's come across in this interview, but I mean, I laugh a lot.
Right.
I cry a lot. I yell. I scream. I live the full gamut.
You care.
Yeah, and I care, and I'm intense. Look, I try to be self-aware. And I try to treat people with respect. but I also try to accomplish the goals that I have for people who are being completely screwed and have no voice. And if it means that you sort of, some people are not going to like you for that, so be it. It's inevitable if you're going to actually create the kind of meaningful change that I think we're creating. I mean, Chevron hates my guts. I mean, you ought to see their emails about me.
Sure.
But, you know, there's also allies, natural allies in the progressive part of the legal community who don't like sort of the way we're going about our business. But, you know, when you break, I believe we're breaking the mold. The amount of resources we brought in, the fact we've been able to actually win a judgment in Ecuador after all these years is precedent setting. It's historic. We still have a lot of challenges. We have a lot of work to do to actually recover the money and do the cleanup, which is the ultimate goal here. But, you know, when you do those types of things, you're going to break furniture and you're going to piss people off. And if you sort of want to live a life where you want everyone to like you, you're not going to be able to do this kind of work effectively. So, by the way, I used to want people to always like me, and I had to learn that it was okay to have people dislike you as long as it's for the right reason. Look, the key to this whole thing is to just understand what's really happening and understand that you've been successful. They want you to believe you failed. They want you to get demoralized. They want you to believe you have mountains to climb. And I see it very clearly. I think this has been a fabulous experience. We've accomplished so much. We've come so far. We have a little bit more distance to go, and I believe we will get there. And they can't stand the fact that we still feel the way we feel about our accomplishment.
It's anyone's guess how Stephen Donziger's fight will end. This is Alec Baldwin. You're listening to Here's the Thing from WNYC Studios.